we go at such a clip, sometimes it seems that we don't have time to enjoy each other. We were going at such a clip this morning, I thought that I didn't mean to overlook you, but we were so short of time that I had to hit the ground running. I usually like to say hello to the people, you know, that we're worshiping with. You know my feelings about you, every one of you. And I know that that really doesn't matter, but, and yet it does too. We matter to each other. But it's just beautiful being here with you and associated with you. I sometimes catch myself smiling at, or grinning probably at some of you as I see you in the audience. It means that much to me as I spot you in different places to know that you're here and that you're a part of this work. I'm thankful that Terry and Charlotte are with us. It's such a great encouragement to me to be associated with that young man and his wife. He was telling me today about one of the classes Ray Wright taught this morning and what a great blessing it was. Terry's a man of God that I love, and I'm thankful for you, Terry, and your work here. I knew a lady some years ago, and the first time I remember talking with her, she was almost totally incapable of functioning as a human being. She was almost completely out of touch with reality. She slept a lot in order to escape reality. In order to not have to face life, she just slept. She didn't drink or take drugs, but she used sleep in an inordinate manner. And by this means, she escaped from having to face the realities of life. She was not able to function as a human being should function. She was burdened down with guilt. She was overwhelmed with anxiety and fear, insecurity, uncertainties. She couldn't function as a wife. Her husband was a very fine man, but he had to pretty well go it alone because she just wasn't capable of functioning as a wife and as a housekeeper. She wasn't capable of functioning as a mother. The husband would have to get up in the mornings and dress the boy and get him off to school. He'd cook breakfast, and the whole work, all of it was on his shoulders because she just simply was out of touch. She would even forget that the boy was in school. She was supposed to pick him up each day, and she'd forget that he was in school. That's how badly affected she was. I think probably she was the most extreme case that I ever saw outside of a mental institution. I began to visit her and talk to her and listen to her, and I discovered where her problem was. It was very obvious. This lady, though she claimed to be a Christian, had no knowledge really of who God was, and she had no knowledge as a result of who she was. She had no faith in God. And I told her one day, I said, your problem is that you don't really have any faith in God. You're trying to operate off of what other people are expecting of you, your husband and the church, your family. You're trying to function off of that basis of what they expect of you, and yet you're not able to measure up to their expectations or to your estimate of their expectations of you. And so as a result, you're depressed and you're trying to escape and you're out of touch with reality because you can't face yourself. Well, you know, finally that sank in on the woman, and she, having come to the realization that she really didn't know who God was and consequently she didn't know who she was, when she came to that realization, she set about to try to find out who God was and to see if she believed in him. And happily, she came to the conclusion that she did. She rendered her obedience to him then in a fullness of faith, and her life took a 180-degree turn for the better. She literally blossomed. You wouldn't believe the transformation that took place in the woman's life. Later on, I asked her if she would write an article for the Bulletin that would describe where it was that she found the key. And so she wrote an article and called it the I, Me, My Syndrome. Everything centered around herself. She gained her identity only in terms of herself in relation to other people, but it was always self-centered. And in this, she described several things, but the focal point of it was that anyone who is living a self-centered life is living a life bordering on insanity. And it's only through a God-centered, neighbor, service-centered life that you actually live a life of saneness and health, mental health. But her I, Me, My is nothing more than what most of us, I say most of us, what most people live by. Her I, Me, My was not all that great, frankly. I never saw a person, she was about 25 or 26, maybe 27 or 28. I never saw a person with, at that age, with as many things against her. And when she compared her I, Me, My with your I, Me, My, she always came in second place. She was epileptic. I think perhaps that she was diabetic. Add those things, which are a burden within themselves, to the almost humorous, if it were not so sad, fact that she had false teeth, and that's not all that bad, but her dentist had made her upper plates where they were buck teethed. I don't know who he was, but he had something evidently against her. So you add all that together, she had buck uppers and then all these other things, and she just didn't have all that much going for her, as long as she was comparing herself with other people. And so she came out with this, not knowing really that she had any value whatsoever, or any real intrinsic, personal, actual worth. The other extreme of that, and it is an extreme that's characteristic of a lot of people, the other extreme of that bad picture, and it is a bad picture in itself, it's just as ugly, but it's the opposite extreme where a person examines his or her I, Me, My, and comes out with simply more supporting evidence for some worth, and they come out with the malady of pride afflicting them. She came out with the other, that of inferiority, insecurity. And then the other extreme, though, is just as dangerous, though it may not be as obvious as far as a person being able to cope, because there's this facade of being able and capable. But it's also a facade, and it's also an expression of insecurity. This thing of pride, and it just simply means that you've examined your I, Me, My, as it relates to other people, and you've come out with a relative rating on the register higher than another person. And so that's what pride really is. Pride, you know, is not being glad that you're rich or smart or good. That's not what pride is. Pride is being glad that you're richer, smarter, and better than other people. And so as a result, we still have this thing of comparing ourselves with ourselves, and both of these people, both the woman that I was referring to and the man who is proud, both of these people have their value of themselves determined by their relationship to other people or their comparison with other people. And consequently, both of them are an insecure position. There's not really any real intrinsic worth that resides in either of these positions. Consequently, both of them are positions of insecurity. Both of them are positions that are built upon the sand. And as the shifting currents take that sand and shift it around, your foundation also shifts, and your estimation of yourself varies depending upon the person with whom you may be associated at that time. And consequently, you don't have any real worth. Both of them, as Paul said, as long as they compare themselves with themselves and measure themselves by themselves, they're always without understanding. Both of them are without any real basic reason for their feeling of worth. The only awareness of our actual worth comes in knowing whose we are, and only then can you know who you are. Do you know whose you are? You know, I could never speak to this congregation without having settled, first of all, whose I am. A preacher cannot stand before a congregation and preach without knowing to whom he's preaching and for whom he's preaching. And I've told you this before. I know for whom I'm preaching. I'm not preaching for you. Thank the Lord, I'm not preaching for this college church. I preach to the college church. I preach for the Lord. And you know, if I didn't have that assurance and that confidence of this assorted or this sorted out relationship that I belong to somebody, and consequently I know who I am, and I know who I am in relationship to you because I know who I am in relationship to God. And as a result, I find that I have a degree of peace of mind and a degree of confidence that doesn't come by my examining my abilities in light of yours, or examining my abilities in the light of yours. I just don't look at it like that. I can't afford to. Man, I can't afford to compare my abilities with anybody. I'm serious. I just don't do it. I won't think about it. On the door, somebody put on the doors of these offices in here in the office complex. They put a 1 on my door and a 7 on Terry's. Well, you know, both of us could react if we were comparing ourselves with ourselves. There are two ways to look at that. If I were like the woman I was telling you about, I'd say, oh, me, I'm number 1 on a scale of 7 and Terry's number 7. Or Terry could say, oh, me, he's got first place and I've got 7th. But in actuality, I don't care what number's on his door or mine. But you see that we don't gain our value by relating ourselves to each other. Our value must come in relationship to God. Let me give you 2 or 3 thoughts that will... I think this is what Augustine was talking about when he said, thou hast made us for thyself, O God, and there is no rest for the soul until it rests in thee. The more I study the Bible, the more I see that there's a whole lot to be said about two words, relation and worth. Relation and worth. And only in your relation to God do you have your worth. And Augustine, when he says, thou hast made us for thyself, that implies possession. And possession implies relation. And relation implies worth. That's the nature of our being. And he says, because of the fact that we were made for God, there just is no real security until we come to that resting place in God. Frankly, I think this is the meaning of the universal phenomena of worship. Are you aware of the fact that there has never been found a tribe of people in any nation, in any location on the earth, there has never been found a tribe of people, civilized or uncivilized, that did not worship something that they considered to be higher than themselves? Do you know what that says? In one respect, it says that they are craving for some awareness of their identity so that they can gain an awareness and an impression of their worth. I think that's what it says. I think this is what Paul was talking about when he spoke to the Athenians and said, and quoted one of their prophets and said, one of your own prophets has said, we are his offspring. Then he drew this conclusion. If we are then God's offspring, we ought not to think of the Godhead as being made of gold or silver or stone, graven after the artifact and imagination of man. After the art and imagination of man. He said we ought not to think of the Godhead like that. If we are really the offspring of God, let's not think of the Godhead as being just simply material, such as gold or silver or stones, and the nature of their form being produced by just simply the art and device of men's creativeness. That's not what, for one reason, it makes you less valuable than what you really are. For another reason, and because of the fact, oh, that's a result, the real issue is that it makes God less than what he is. But once you make that to whom you belong less valuable than he ought to be, then not naturally you're going to be less valuable yourself than you ought to be. So I think here again he's talking about relation and value. Who are you? Well, you won't know until you know whose you are. And once you find out whose you are, then you're going to have a pretty good idea about who you are. All right, there's one other thought, then I'm going to make some implications. The 23rd Psalm is one of the most simple and beautiful definitions of relationship And consequently, one of the clearest delineations and explanations of worth that we have in the whole Bible. The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. He makes me to lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters. He restores my soul. He leads me in paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for thou art with me. Thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. Thou preparest before me a table in the presence of mine enemies. Thou anointest my head with oil. My cup runs over. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I'll dwell in the house of the Lord forever. There again is relationship and worth. There again is relationship and security. He didn't say, I'll never want because the price of wool is up this year. Or and it's a known thing that people can't live without wool, and so consequently I'm secure. He wasn't talking about his worth in relationship to the common market value of wool. His worth or his value was an intrinsic value based upon his relationship to his Lord. As long as he was aware of the fact that God was his shepherd, then he says, I just won't ever want. Well, all right, now, there are some implications about this, and I mentioned this morning, and I didn't have time really to develop it, but I want to draw some implications. First of all, I want you to see what the issue is. The issue is whether or not you have a good self-image of yourself. What's your self-image? If you're able to see yourself in relation to God as a person who, because of your worth, merited, in a sense, the death of God's own Son, that if you are that important and that valuable that God would give his own life, a part of himself for you, then you've got something going for you. It doesn't make any difference how you produce. It doesn't make any difference what you are in many respects. It just simply means that God loves you because simply you were born, you were created in his likeness. You are a person who has intrinsic value. And let me tell you, a person who comes to the age of maturity without bringing with him a good self-image, that person is a number one candidate for the mental institution. The people that Terry and I and these others counsel, they're in the throes of this uncertainty of knowing who they are. And their image of themselves is next to nil. It's either been created like that by their parents, and that's where it usually comes from. The parents did not instill in the child a sense of a real, genuine value and intrinsic worth. What is your value? What's your worth? What is your self-image? Can you look at yourself in the mirror each morning? Do you know whose you are? Do you know then who you are? And do you know how valuable you are? Without these questions being answered in an affirmative way to say, yes, I know who I am, and consequently, I know who I am. And if you can come to God and stand before people and stand in relationship to other people knowing whose you are, then knowing who you are, then you're going to make it all right. Otherwise, you're not going to make it too well. Let me give you some implications of this, and the lesson is yours. Some implications for ourselves. Having come to know who we are because we know whose we are, we're able to love ourselves. You're able to love yourself. I don't mean in a way that's haughty and proud. I'm talking about genuine love. And it affects every relationship of our life. Because we're able to love ourselves in a genuine way, because of the fact that we know whose we are, and we gain our worth from knowing this God and knowing our relationship to him, because he is our shepherd, and we know that he rewards us, and he provides, and he gives, and he protects, and he saves. Because we know all of this in our relationship, and our worth depends upon our relationship to him. Watch what happens in your work. All the tensions and the pressures to achieve and to secure a feeling of worth because of achievement and recognition, all of those tensions and pressures disappear. Consequently, in your work, you're able to function freely because there's no tension, there's no pressure. You know that your worth is already established with God, and you're not being able to sell this month, or you're doing such maybe a bad job today, doesn't really affect you to the point that you can't hold on to reality. You know whose you are, and consequently you know who you are, and it affects the way you do your work. It affects your personal relationships. All of the defense mechanisms, all of the jealousies, the chips on your shoulder, the suspicions, the resentments, all of these things disappear because you don't have to be on a defense, you see, against someone else, because you're not competing with other people. You're already aware of your worth. You already stand before God as someone whom God has accepted and someone that God says, I love you and you are valuable to me. So you're not in competition with me. I'm not in competition with you. I don't feel in competition to any gospel preacher in the world. Just don't. Maybe I'm so far out of the running that doesn't pay, but I just don't feel in the competition. Do you feel in competition with people with whom you are competing? Do you feel in competition with them? Or can you say to those people, you know, I'm just so thankful for you, and you just go right on and do what, you know, do the very best you can. I'm right there behind you all the way. Well, knowing whose you are and then knowing who you are makes our personal relations work in a very beautiful way. Thirdly, we find no need to sound the trumpet in our religious life. Jesus said, when you give your alms, don't sound a trumpet. Why did he say that? Thus, when you give alms, sound no trumpet before you, as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and in the streets, that they may be praised by men. Such people get their sense of worth because of what other people are saying about them. But there's got to be something below that. There's got to be something broader than that. These people were sounding trumpets in the sense that they wanted other people to see what they were doing, because that's where they got their sense of value of themselves. But he says, if you'll just be aware of the fact that God is the one that rewards you, you won't have to sound any trumpets. So what it lets us do in our personal relationships, in our working relationships, in our worship relationship, as far as our godliness and our religious life, it lets us just simply relax and be simply and openly aware of God, to where we know where our worth comes from. And consequently, all these pressures and tensions and anxieties and resentments and chips and defense mechanisms and all of this that so disrupt human relationships and so thwart our efforts to do good, all of these things just melt away because we don't care, really. We have our relationship with God, and because of that, we know who we are. Yeah, these are some of the side effects that come to those of us just simply personally. But then there's something that comes to your neighbor as a result of this also. If you're a person who knows whose you are, and knowing whose you are, you know who you are, it's not that just some good things come to you. Some good things come to your neighbor also. You know what it is? As you are, in terms of yourself, able to love yourself, one of the things that comes to your neighbor is that you learn to love your neighbor like you love yourself. And this spill-off, or the spillover, and the spin-off of having come to know who you are because you know whose you are, and that your value is not in terms, relative terms, related to how other people do and who they are. That's not where you get your worth. You've got a solid basis upon which to examine and come to the conclusion, you know, I'm valuable in God's eyes. It has a spin off to your neighbor. You're then able to love your neighbor like you love yourself. That's why Paul says, that's why he could say in the 12th chapter of the book of Romans, listen to this, love one another with brotherly affection. Outdo one another in showing honor. How are you going to do that? How are you going to go around showing honor to other people? Won't that make you appear to be less honorable? Oh, no. And you can do it if you've got your worth established with God. You can just give honor to whomever it's due. You can just do it without ever even worrying. That's why he also could say in the Corinthian letter, chapter 12 and verse 26, the latter part, where it says, if one member is honored, all rejoice together. Rather than sullying up, you know, when somebody is presented with a plaque for outstanding duties or outstanding service, rather than sullying up and thinking, he ain't so hot. I've done that well myself. No, you don't do like that. If your value with God has been established, you just literally burst at the seams when some old boy that you know really hadn't, he hadn't really got it all together either, but somebody recognized something good in him, it makes you say, man, amen, let him have it. Outdo each other in showing honor, and when somebody else shows honor, just burst at the seams out of pride for that fellow and what he's accomplished. Be thankful for it. And then in Ephesians, it also says that you're able to forgive other people. Colossians also, Ephesians 4 and Colossians 3. Listen to what he says. Let all bitterness and wrath and anger and clamor and slander be put away from you with all malice. That's these resentments and things that come from people and to people who find themselves competing with other people. Put them away, and you can do it once your value and your worth has been established with God. And be kind to one another, tender-hearted, forgiving one another, as God in Christ forgave you. See, there's your value right there. It's been established by God. He forgave you. So then you can forgive other people once you come to that conclusion. This is what Simon Peter was talking about when he said in 1 Peter 1:22, seeing that you have purified your souls in your obedience to the truth unto genuine love of the brethren, love one another from the heart fervently. Genuine love. How does it come about? It comes about simply because of the fact that we saw in the death of Jesus Christ our worth, and we respond to that, he says, in your obedience to the truth, in our surrender to God, in this action of faithful obedience, turning from sin, being immersed, touching the death of Jesus Christ in baptism, and being raised to walk this new life. But that new life is characterized by an unrelenting, genuine love of each other, to where we want the very best for all of us, everybody, unto unfeigned love of the brethren, love each other from the heart fervently. Both of these things then are spinoffs of having come to realize who we are, because we know whose we are. When Jesus Christ gave the two great commandments, when he reiterated what the Old Testament said about them, the second one of those contains the two we've talked about tonight. Thou shalt love thy neighbor as you love yourself. And that's what we've talked about mainly. And yet both of these have been based upon the assumption, and it's a well-founded assumption, that both of these are based upon your awareness of God and your love for him. And that's the first one of these two commandments. Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, soul, mind, and strength. There's where we get this worth of ourselves, because we see who it is that we belong to, whose we are. And then he says, once you've seen that, then you can love your neighbor like you love yourself, because your love for yourself will be genuine once you've realized whose you are. And then your love for your fellow man will be genuine, because you can love him as you love yourself. And you love yourself because of what you see that God loves. He loves you because, not necessarily because of what you are. Sometimes it's in spite of what you are. In fact, all the time it's in spite of what you are. But he loves you anyway. These are some of the things. This is part of the fullness of life that comes to the person who's in Jesus Christ. Consequently, we're left to be free, without the restrictions, without the inhibitions, without the burdens that weigh us down of guilt and of insecurity and of all of these things that so impede the progress of human beings. It just lets us, we snip free of all these things, and then we come into the very fullness of the sons of God. And we can walk like that in the presence of God, and we can let other people walk like that, to where everybody begins to grow up in this fullness of life that comes by being in Christ. Know whose you are, and then you'll be able to know who you are, and then knowing who you are, you'll be able to love yourself, and by the way, you'll be able then in turn to love other people like you love yourself. Have you come into that fullness of life yet or not? Or are you still eaten up with anxieties and resentments and your defense mechanisms? You know, people just offer a gentle criticism and you back off and say, well, who do you think you are? Where are you tonight? What's your value? Once you establish it with God, then everything begins to smooth out. Your home, your job, your being a student in school, wherever you may be, it all begins to smooth out, because you've got your relationship with God right, and that value system that comes as a result that just simply says you're all right. God accepts you and loves you. You'll pass it on to other people. Tonight we're going to extend the invitation to you. If you love the Lord, if you see that there's where my worth comes, and I'm so thankful that he loved me enough to give himself for me on the cross, wouldn't you like to come and say, Lord, I don't know why, I don't understand it, but I believe it, and I accept it. I don't have any other choice. and I accept it and I thank you for it. Wouldn't you come in faithfulness then and surrender yourself to him in obedience in this action of baptism that touches that highest expression of God's expression of your worth? Wouldn't you come and be united with him then in that one beautiful action whereby you're then raised to walk a new life of love of the brethren because you've learned to love yourself through having accepted God's evaluation of your worth? That's the gospel. Would you accept it while we stand and sing?